before we get into today's show, I'd like to take a moment to invite you to share your thoughts and opinions on our work. If you have feedback, ideas, or suggestions regarding any part of our overall platform, we'd love to hear from you. Please don't hesitate to reach out. We're listening. Your insights help us to grow and ensure that we're making the greatest impact possible. To share your thoughts, go to insightmyanmar.org/feedback. Pleased to be joined on this episode of Insight Myanmar podcast with Professor Francois Nostin, who has spent nearly four decades on the Thai-Myanmar border, where he founded the Shoklo Malaria Research Unit in 1986. His work has bridged frontline humanitarian care with groundbreaking scientific research, leading to treatments now recommended worldwide. Having witnessed everything from refugee crises and conflict on the border to the post-coup displacement and collapsing health systems, Professor Nostin remains one of the foremost voices on malaria and public health in conflict zones. I should also add that in 2018, France honored him with the Légion d'honneur in recognition for over three decades of fighting malaria on the border. Today, we will be tracing his journey from the earliest days on the border to Myanmar's recent crisis with malaria at the very heart of this story. So, Professor Nostin, thank you so much for taking time to join us for this interview.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start, as the introduction indicated, you have been on the border for a long time. You have quite an institutional history of seeing what has been going on at the border, especially through the prism of conflict and especially through disease. And so to set the context for the conversation that follows, you arrived, I believe it was in the 1980s that you first arrived on the border. This is at a time when refugee camps were swelling with people fleeing the conflict. What can you tell us? What brought you to the border at those times? And what do you remember about the situation and the context when you arrived?
Well, at that time in 1984, I was working for MSF, which is Médecins Sans Frontières. It's a French NGO, Doctor Without Borders. And I was working on the Thai-Cambodian border, so that's on the other side of Thailand, where a lot of Cambodian refugees had arrived fleeing the Vietnamese army and the Khmer Rouge. So I was working there, and in March 1984, MSF asked me to come to the Thai-Myanmar border, which was called Burma, Thai-Burma border at that time, because some Karen refugees just arrived from Burma, fleeing the conflict there. And they were settling in not very large numbers, but they were settling in small camps along the River Moy, which is the border between Thailand and Burma. And MSF wanted to have an evaluation of the situation and what sort of healthcare the people needed and so on and so forth. So I came here. That was March 1984, and that was for MSF. And what I remember about it, well, it's 40 years ago, but I remember that Mesot, where I live and work still now today, was a small town, much smaller than now, and that the refugees were living in small camps, a small village. In fact, they were more like villages. There was no any trace, no evidence of any presence of Thai military or police or any authorities checking on them, because all the attention was on the other side of the country, on the Thai Khmer border, on the Cambodian border. So here, really, nobody cares. And so we started to work in the camps, and pretty soon it became obvious that the first number one problem, health problem of the people living in those camps, those Karen refugees, was malaria. And there were a lot of cases of malaria. So that's what we started working with MSF on, malaria and other diseases, but that's my first big contact with malaria.
Right. So then, and malaria is at the heart of this story in terms of how the different strands of the disease and the ability to fight it back with vaccines. How that has changed over the years. And I'm trying to figure out how to navigate and scaffold this conversation, because we have several different threads that are interlocking and kind of carry on in their own trajectory. I think before we get deep into malaria, I think the next question I want to ask you concerns the border issues again, because you mentioned arriving there in 1984. And of course, in 1988, this is the whole democracy movement, and Myanmar is rocked by nationwide pro-democracy uprisings that ends with a brutal military crackdown. Tens of thousands, largely students, fled to the Thai-Myanmar border, joining these longstanding waves of refugees that were already there from ethnic conflicts, especially in the Karen areas. In researching for this interview, I saw that you would reference this was one of the worst periods you witnessed. The camps were suddenly swelling in size and disease. Malaria and TB were rampant. I wonder if you can, so just 4 years later now from 84 and contrasting this, you know, I think this is also a helpful contrast with today. Can you take us back to that moment post 88? What made it such a breaking point for both migrants and health workers, and how that crisis shaped your path of work from then on?
Well, in 1988, that's 4 years later, I was not working for MSF anymore. I had already started to work on this malaria research project. So I had left MSF, and I was working with a team at Mahidol University. Mahidol University is a large university in Thailand, in Bangkok. And there is a network of a research institute linked with Oxford University in the UK. So I had joined that group, and I was working in the camps of refugees on malaria, and I was doing some research work on prophylaxis of malaria, how to prevent malaria from affecting and killing people, especially pregnant women, because a lot of pregnant women in the camps were dying every year because they had malaria during pregnancies. And then in 1988 came, you know, in fact, actually in the following year, in 1989, came the ABSDF students, so the old Burma Democratic Movement of the students fleeing the coup in Rangoon and the violence from the Burmese military. And they didn't come in numbers inside the camps in Thailand. They came more in settlement on the currents on the other side of the border, also on the Burmese side of the border. But the what I remember about those and how it shaped the future work is that there was so much of cases of malaria, and these young students were so unused to get malaria because they came from Rangoon and the big cities. There is no malaria, so a lot of them died actually because of malaria, and there were more of the students dying of malaria than from the fighting, and that's put in contrast with the recent years after the coup in 2021, when a lot of young people came from the big cities as well, and they So they went all over the place, but in particular, they came on the border with Thailand, and they came in the area controlled by the Karen, the Karen groups, and no one got malaria at all. And so the difference between 1988 and 2021 is that in the meantime, there was all these years of work to combat malaria, to deal with the drug resistance, so the resistance in the parasite, because malaria is caused by a family of parasites, and these parasites, some of them become resistant to the drugs, and so for many years we had to understand the resistance and overcome the resistance with new treatment, new drugs that we were introducing at that time. And we also tried the vaccine that you mentioned in 1992-93, but it didn't work. So the protection from that vaccine was zero, and so it was abandoned. But the fight continued against malaria, and finally we overcame the disease, and there is no more malaria now in the refugee camps are still there. They are still here. There are still some refugees, about 90,000, but they don't have any more malaria cases in the camps. And there is no more malaria in the population outside the camp, which is larger than the one in the camps. The population of non-Thai outside the camps is a mixture of migrants and people fleeing also from the problem in Myanmar. Also in this population, malaria is not a problem anymore. And even in the Karen state, malaria has been very much reduced over the years. So how this timeline, if you want, from 1988, I started this work in 1986, but in 1988, there was this uprising. There was this problem on the border. There was influx of refugees, so population of Karen fleeing, but also other villages, other populations. So they were the swelling of the camp population. So we continued to work in the camps until 2007 or 2009, and then after that we focused on the population outside the camps, which is much larger. And so for all these years, we combined the work on research, trying to improve the knowledge and the treatment of the disease, but also on humanitarian work to try to alleviate the problem for the population.
I just want to go back to your descriptions of 1988. I mean, this sounded horrific, of all these young students that were fleeing military crackdowns, that were from cities, their systems were not used to these diseases, and just the level of devastation and really death of how many of these young students succumb to a really vicious form of malaria then. As far as it's possible to remember, being a young doctor at that time, being trying to do your best to be able to help in any way possible in those really impossible situations, can you take our listeners back and just describe the scene, if we were to step into what you saw those many decades ago, what was the scene, and what was the situation like as far as you can remember on the ground?
Well, first you have to realize that the malaria was a problem not only for the students that came from the big cities. It was also a big problem for the population living here, the Karen population, and it was the first. In 1988, malaria was the first cause of disease in the camp and the first cause of death. So it means that we had a small clinic, a small hospital in the camp. So the camps were like village in the forest. We were inside the forest, difficult to access. We had to access with the four-wheel drives or on foot. And we had a small hospital in bamboo and leaves. I had a house. I lived 10 years inside the camp in a bamboo house. Wow. And we were living next to the hospital. So the hospital was made and equipped so that we could treat patients, children and adults alike. with for malaria and other diseases, but mostly malaria. And we could also see pregnant women during the pregnancy. They would come regularly to our clinic, and we will screen their blood. And if we find that one has malaria, she will be treated immediately. So one of the first impacts of our presence in the camps was that the mortality in the mothers due to malaria, this mortality dropped from very high level to nothing. There was no more woman who died of malaria after we introduced that screening. So we were living in those camps. We were working in various places with a team. So we were going from camp to camp. And we were also advising MSF, because MSF was still there. They were still the main medical NGO in the camp. So we were in close collaboration with MSF and with the Thai hospital also. And we were updating them on the level of resistance. And for example, in 1991, so a few years later, we could prove and demonstrate that that the drug that we were using at that time was not as effective as it used to be. And so we had to change the treatment. We had to modify the treatment. So we could explain and demonstrate that with data, with evidence, and showing that we had to change the treatment and the new treatment was working better. And so immediately MSF adopted the new treatment, and soon after the Thai program also changed their treatment. So we could by combining intervention and research, we of course published the result into a medical journal and things like that. So we could have an impact very quickly on the way that people were being treated in the camps and around the camps. So I would not, as far as I can remember. In the 90s, and it was not a bad situation in a way. It was bad for as far as health was concerned, because we had to fight against a disease which killed a lot of children and adults. But we were the environment in which we were working was not that terrible. It was less stressful, for example, that some of the camps that I known before in Africa or even in Cambodia. So it became a problem more in the years later, in 2000, when the problem between Thailand and Myanmar escalated, and there was some tension on the border. There was some, but the first 10 years were quite, how should I put this? It was hard work. It was a lot of work, but it was rewarding because of the result that we were getting. And the overall environment of work was, of course, apart from some of the violence, some of the fighting. But actually, in 1988, for example, the fighting was quite far away. We could still, we could live on the border without much fear. You have to wait until 1996, so 10 years later, where there was a split in the Karen movement, and there was some fight among people, and the fighting came closer to the border. There was even some incursion on the Thai side, so some of the camp were burnt down, were attacked. So we had to hide into some bunkers and under fire. But that was later. That was in 1995. So that was more tense at that time.
And you're describing how you came here on assignment originally with MSF, and then over the time you set up your own practice and clinic, and you mentioned living in a refugee camp for 10 years. I mean, these are not easy conditions for you to live in, to say nothing of just the actual comfort of that living, but the tensions between the different nations and military groups, the presence of the afflicted that you're helping, and those living in really dire situations. So I'm just curious, what drove that decision for you to put yourself in this place where I think a lot of our listeners, you know, checking ourselves and thinking if we would make some of those decisions at that same time, you know, I don't know how many of us would. So what drove that decision-making process of you to want to put yourself in that position to help in the way that you did?
It's not an easy question to answer. I think that, I had worked for MSF for years before. I went to Africa, I went to West Africa, I went to Uganda. I worked in various difficult conditions before. And that's what I wanted to do as a doctor. I did my medical school to be able to travel and to do something that I think was useful. So for me, it was... And you have to try to put yourself into the mood in the 70s and 80s, where people like me, we were, you know, young people, 30 years old, we still had a lot of ideals and ideal, you know, we still thought at that time that we could do something to change the conditions of some, you know, the people. We still had some illusions, so to speak. So I, for me, it was natural to do it. It was not, I didn't sort of sacrifice myself to do this. I thought that living in the camps and working there and doing what I did and still do now, researching on the disease like that and finding solutions to treat and prevent and understand, was useful. And is useful, and for that I had to combine, because I could have also worked into a lab or a laboratory or somewhere in the US or in the West or in England or in France, and work on malaria as well. I have some friends who have done that, but that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to see patients. I wanted to be a clinician. And so I could combine my desire to be a clinician with the desire to be a researcher and to understand what was going on. So combining those two curiosity or these two desires meant that I was in the best place I could be, because I was in the middle of the place where it happens. There was malaria transmission in the camps. We could study the vectors, the mosquitoes. We could catch mosquitoes. We could see that the mosquitoes were infected with parasites. We could follow the children. We could prevent pregnant women from dying. I also set up a small clinic where they could come and deliver their babies, because before that, they would deliver their babies in their house. And that was not safe, because it's not safe. So we provided them with a place where they could deliver their babies safely with trained midwife and a bit of equipment. So that, and also I had a car, I had a four-wheel drive with chains, you know, on the tires. When the rainy season came, we had to use chains to be able to drive outside the camp. And I could take the woman to the hospital to have a cesarean section to get operated. So there was a very rewarding position, and still is, because of the impact that you have on lives of people. So I think that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I've been doing for all these years. Now I'm reaching an age where I should give, you know, I should hand over to younger generation to do it, to continue the work, but that's not an easy task, because as you alluded to, it's not that easy to find people who are going to want to live here. Although Mesot is, you know, we have now a good connection with the internet, as you can imagine. Thailand is a country that works, so the logistics is there, electricity is there, so the comfort in the Mesot is fine. But But still, you know, it's difficult to find experienced people who are willing to spend some years here, relatively isolated from the rest of the world. For example, yeah, so it's not that simple. It's not that simple to find what the succession plan of what the succession will be. But I'm still trying.
Yeah, I imagine that's a fascinating backstory that you provide. And I want to now shift and move this conversation into the thread of a deep dive on malaria itself. And before we get into that, to provide some background of this conversation, when I first proposed the idea of this conversation, your response was you didn't know if anyone would want to sit and listen for 2 hours on malaria. As it would happen, I was after we met, I was meeting with another friend and referenced that comment to him. And this happened to be an individual who was he's from Australia. He was a monk in Burma in the 19 late 70s, early 80s. And he was stricken with malaria on the border at that time, which was, you know, the really terrible strand of it. And it was a moment that shaped his life. You know, he's talked over the years I've known him of the intensity of pain that he experienced. This is a monk who's, you know, whose spiritual vocation is to observe the experience of suffering, and he's described the level of suffering that he incurred. While he had malaria, he said that he just kept thinking to himself at that time, death would be better than this. Death would be much, much, I would welcome death compared to this level of pain and suffering I've experienced all these years later. He's referenced that his own journey of suffering set him on an inquiry of the history of malaria, which he then shared with me, which made me much more fascinated than even before to want to do this deep dive into well, not just malaria, border issues, other things as well, but malaria being the center of that. So I want to provide some context that I went through in researching to set you up for a question of your work and your proximity to this disease. The truth is, as I started to learn, malaria has been really one of the great hidden forces shaping much of human history and destiny. Ancient writers suggested that it may have claimed Alexander the Great at the height of his empire. So, you know, malaria was, you know, Alexander the Great defeated everything except for malaria. In Rome, there were repeated outbreaks in the marshes. It weakened the legions and eroded the empire's resilience. Centuries later, it was during the colonial period, it had the nickname the White Man's Grave, killing so many colonizers in Africa and Asia. It literally set boundaries where empires could expand. And in the Americas, you know, the Panama Canal could not be completed until mosquito control turned back malaria and yellow fever after thousands had died. Shifting here to Southeast Asia, malaria has been as much as an adversary as any opposing army. Look at World War II's Burma campaign. It incapacitated up to 80% of some battalions. Malaria was killing more than the actual enemy, more than bullets ever did. Long after the war, insurgents and military in Myanmar, they have found themselves in a perpetual fight against it in the jungle. And today, as we've talked about, civilians and resistance fighters, they face that same invisible enemy in the borderlands. To a different degree. But to frame this whole malaria conversation, when you step back from the clinic and laboratory and you look at malaria as this global historical thing, how do you see it not just as a disease, but as a force that has shaped the very boundaries and possibilities of civilization? And how has then living through its grip on the Thai-Myanmar border frontier altered your own sense of its place in human history?
Wow. Just before I start, maybe for your listeners, because some people may not know, but you know the CDC, right? The US CDC in Atlanta,
Yes.
which has been under threat recently. This agency was created for dealing with malaria in the US. And so it was in charge of trying to control malaria as a disease in the US. So it has indeed impacted many countries, all the continent. In fact, If you go back not very long ago, 200 or 300 years ago, there was malaria in most of Europe. So it has shaped a lot of the different civilizations, and it's a disease which is fascinating. Obviously, I find it more and more interesting as more I study it, the more I find it interesting, but not interesting only because of the biology, but also because of this link between the disease and the history of human settlement. And it's a disease which is very much also linked to human conflict, as you pointed out. But you could also mention about the Vietnam conflict. You could mention about the U.S. intelligence service dropping medicine for Ho Chi Minh during the Vietnam conflict in the northern Vietnam because he was dying of malaria. You could mention about Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh, agreeing to develop a new treatment because of the casualties during the Vietnam conflict on the northern in for the Viet Cong. They were losing many men to malaria, so Ho Chi Minh approached Mao Zedong to get, and that's how Mao Zedong ordered his scientists to find a new cure for malaria, and that's how they found artemisinin, which is now one of the cornerstone medicine for the treatment. In the meantime, so that's back in the 70s, the U.S. military were developing new drugs for their troops, and that's what we still use now. Chloroquine came from the German military in the Second World War. Mefloquine came from the U.S. military. So it's very much the link between the disease and the war and the human conflict. And during the Second World War, for example, the Japanese wanted to control Java and Sumatra because of the plantation of quinine. So that's the quinine was the only natural drug against malaria, and they wanted to control that because who controlled the quinine production could give quinine to its soldiers and protect them against malaria. So it's very much entangled. And still now, of course, as you mentioned, until recent years, but it has been there for a problem for the guerrilla troops and the people fighting and living in the Southeast Asian countries. But in recent years, it has receded from most of Southeast Asian country, like the Greater Mekong region. So if you look at Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, malaria is not a problem for the populations anymore. It's not a problem for the military anymore. But there is only one country where it's still a significant problem, is in Myanmar, because of the problems, because of the instability, because of the healthcare system has collapsed, because of the fighting, because of the insecurity. So, in other words, if you have a stable country who's developing, even slowly, even if it's poor, but it's developing and it's stable and it's peaceful, you can control malaria, you can get rid of it. But if you have troubles, instability, population displacement, like look at Venezuela, for example. It's not to talk about Southeast Asia, but talk about Venezuela, for example. Venezuela was going through a phase of development and oil was bringing a lot of money into the country, and malaria was disappearing, and then everything collapsed, and then now malaria started again and exploded again in Venezuela. So that's another example of the link between the fact that a country can be slowly but surely getting rid of the disease, because it's possible with the tool that we have now, the tools that we have now, we can very well get rid of malaria. But it's not possible to do it if the country is unstable or the healthcare system is too corrupted. It's too, the level of corruption is too high, or there's too much fighting, or there's too much displacement of people, like in Sudan or or in Democratic Republic of Congo, or, and then that's impossible to win that one. So malaria will still be with us for very, very many years to come. Not because it's impossible to get rid of it because of its nature, but because of human causes of reason caused by humans, not because of the, because getting rid of, I'm talking about falciparum malaria, because maybe what you have to, and your auditors have to understand, is that there are several different types of malaria. There are five different parasites. So, but most of the time when we talk about malaria, we talk about one, the dangerous one, which is falciparum malaria. And falciparum malaria is the one that kills a million people every year. And it's the one that is becoming resistant to drug easily. But there are other types of malaria that are less severe, but they are still quite a significant burden for the population. But whether it's falciparum or other species of malaria, it's possible to eliminate them, say, not eradicate. The difference between eradicate and eliminate is that eradication means that there is no more organism in the whole world, and so it's gone from everywhere, from the lab, from everywhere. Eliminate means that it's been suppressed as a disease. So it's still, you can still find the organism somewhere, the parasite, in a lab or somewhere, but it doesn't cause any disease. That's called elimination. So we can eliminate malaria. We can prevent people and pregnant women and children from dying from malaria. But for that, you need to have certain conditions. And one of the conclusions of this 40 years of work on the border with the population here, which is the border population here on both sides of the border, is in fact between different systems. They are not really covered by the Thai system, and they are not covered by the Myanmar system. So they are in between. So working in that population and providing this population with some services, some access to medicine and diagnostics and healthcare, we can see what the impact of the different factors, what factors are needed to eliminate malaria. And by and large, if you compare 1988 or 1990 to 2025, there is much, much, much less malaria cases now than there used to be. So malaria is not a significant problem anymore. It could come back. That's another thing we know with malaria, is that it can go and come back. It did the same in Sri Lanka. It went away from Sri Lanka and came back after troubles in the country. It did come back in Venezuela, for example. So it could come back to current state easily. It's not completely eliminated, but it could rise again. Now it's a significant problem elsewhere in Myanmar. We don't have exactly the figures because there are no reliable data, but we know that there is still a significant problem. So it's not a problem very much in other parts of Southeast Asia. So people can travel to, let's say, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, of course, and Vietnam without risking getting malaria. But in Myanmar, it's a different picture.
So as we track and trace the development over time of malaria, it's, as you pointed out just now, it's important to talk about these different strands and the five different strands, two of which are quite prevalent in Myanmar. Looking at the strand of, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the falciparum. Looking at this strand of it, which is has been much more vicious, but also been not as prevalent today. But malaria is often discussed in terms of statistics, but for millions that suffer from it and ultimately succumb to it, it's a profoundly personal experience of suffering. And it begins with a mosquito bite. It's a silent incubation in the liver before erupting into these cycles of fever, chill, sweat, exhaustion, sometimes in the case of falciparum, leading to seizures, coma, even death, as we've mentioned. You've treated thousands of patients in your medical experience, many of whom have been at death's door. Can you describe, so we're going beyond the numbers and understanding how this disease is really impacting people as they get it. Can you describe what it actually feels like for those who were so unfortunate to get this strand of malaria, both for the patient enduring it, as well as the medical staff and the doctor that is trying to pull them back from the brink?
Well, I can try, but I cannot speak about my own experience because I never got malaria. So I don't know exactly what it does to you, but I can share with you what my experience as a physician is to treat patients with malaria. And so it can take a spectrum, a variety of shapes and forms. And if you want, you can have episodes of malaria which are, first of all, you can have malaria parasite in your blood and not have any symptoms. You are perfectly healthy, perfectly fine, and no fever, nothing at all. That can happen. But it can also be that the parasite is going to multiply, and more the parasite multiplies in your blood, because the parasite is in the blood, red blood cells. The more the parasite population grows, the sicker you are. So if you have a little bit of parasite, you are a little bit sick. If you have a lot of parasite, you are very sick. So there is a correlation between the number of parasites in the blood and the level of sickness. And it can usually manifest itself as, people coming to the clinic with fevers. Fever is a very, very, the most common signs of malaria, of falciparum malaria, is fever. So they have fever. The fever is going up and down and up and down and up and down. So it's a profound fever, a lot of sweating, headache, and the children are vomiting, some have diarrhea, some have abdominal pain. So it's a disease that makes you really sick. If you don't treat it early, then you are more and more sick. So you are going through phases. So you are very, very sick, and then you get better. And there is, when you get better, when the fever goes down, and then the pain is going away, you feel like a little bit euphoric. You know, it's, oh really, God, it's nice, and then you are a bit like, and then it comes back again, and then. And that is because of the cycle of the parasite. The parasite goes through cycles, different stages, and then when it bursts into new parasite, then that's where you have the fever, and then when you feel very bad. And then it carries on like this for several days. And finally, the parasite gets to your brain, and there you get into serious trouble because you become unconscious, you have seizures, and you can die. It also gets into other vital organs like the kidney, like the lungs, like the liver. And then it can create troubles with the functions of these other essential organs. So when it's really getting bad, you have a patient with multiple organ dysfunctions. So the kidney don't work anymore, it doesn't pass urine. And finally the brain stops working because it's full of parasite. There is no more oxygen going to your neural cell, to your neurons in the brain. And then death. And then it's a disease that can deceive the clinician who is not used to it very easily. It can take different shape, it can change its appearance. So as a young doctor not used to see malaria cases, you can easily get defeated, and you can think that, oh well, this is a meningitis, but it's in fact not, it's malaria. And but when you have seen cases, you learn how to recognize it. And but I still remember vividly the face of a pregnant woman that I saw in 1988 or 89, who came walking to the clinic. She was walking on her own, and she said that she had abdominal pain. She was pregnant. And I checked her and I thought, maybe she has a urinary infection, which is quite common in pregnancy. So I asked the lab to collect a little bit of urine and check with the microscope whether there was any infection there. And I also asked another technician to check her blood just in case. And in fact, she had malaria. And by the time she was diagnosed with malaria, she was dead. So by the from the time when she arrived on the 2 feet and the time she died, there was 2 hours. Wow. So you see that it can be something that is very brutal, and so it means that you need to respond very quickly. You can't just say to somebody, well, you know, it may be malaria, but it may not be. Come back tomorrow, we'll see, because tomorrow may be too late. Maybe the patient will be dead already. So you can't do that. You have to be. So that one of the things that we spend quite a lot of time in the early days to train the medics, the local health workers and things, is to react quickly to quickly have a diagnostic. So at that time, there was no other way, but we had microscopes. So we trained them to use microscopes. We trained them to take a blood sample, to look at the blood with the microscope and to find the parasite. And if that test was positive, then to treat early, quickly. And so that was part of the early training. And when you do that systematically, you test and treat systematically early, quickly, then the people don't die anymore. And then gradually the number of cases goes down, 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 down. And finally you eliminate it. You have to be perseverant and patient, and you have to continue the effort for long enough, but at the end it works. So it's a bad disease, but you can beat it.
So let's talk about beating it then, because that segues right into how, as we're talking about these particularly devastating impacts of the strand of falciparum, we're talking about decades ago. The story that you told is decades ago. The story of my Australian friend is decades ago. So this is a two-part question. The first is, how did the success come of this strand no longer being the real danger and devastation that it was, you know, historically, not just on the border, but all of human history, as we've talked about. And then on the flip side of that, we have the Vivex strand, which is less often fatal, but it's far more stubborn. It hides in the liver, you relapse again and again. And I see that 90% of cases now on the border are, as I understand it, are now VVAX. So the second part of this question then, after the success of being able to eliminate, I think is the word that you called upon, the more devastating strand, how then are these parasites different in terms of the way they strike, the way they persist, and the way they shape people's lives, and why is VVAX proving so much harder to eliminate?
Well, first part of the question, so on falciparum, it has been a success here, it has been a success in other parts of the Southeast Asia, it's been a success in some countries. It's been, if you go back in time, in the 18th century, there was a lot of falciparum malaria in Italy, so it's been eliminated from all the European countries. It's been eliminated for the US. It's been eliminated from all the countries that developed, basically. So all the countries that developed managed to eliminate the malaria transmission there through various means. But in the modern era, then there have been some success. And the success here is based simply on the fact that if you provide the people with access to diagnostic and treatment, adequate treatment early on, so within 24 or 48 hours of fever, then you eliminate falciparum. And we have proven that 25 years ago with a project that we did on the Thai side of the border. Actually, it was the first time in history that the Gates Foundation was providing a budget for a project in its history. And they provided this budget for us to eliminate falciparum from the Thai side. And that's how we did it. We, in every village, we trained somebody to use a test, not microscope, because it was that time at the beginning of the rapid diagnostic test. So it's very easy to teach. It's very easy to do and to treat. And so 1 year later, malaria was gone from the Thai side. And so we did that again on the Myanmar side, on the Burmese side of the border, and that worked as well. So the elimination of falciparum from all the village is simply the fact that if you can provide in the village, at the doorstep of the people, quickly a diagnosis and a treatment, so that the mother doesn't have to take her child 3 hours walk to the next clinic, but it's in the village where she lives, where he lives, where the father lives, where the child lives, that if they have fever, within 48 hours, they can have a diagnosis and a treatment. If you do that, you eliminate falciparum malaria. So that's how we did it, and it works. You just need to be able to do it. So you understand that what it means is that you have to be able to supply each village with the tests that they need for malaria, the treatment that they need to treat the patient, falciparum cases, and you need a bit of training. But you need that. If you can do that, if you have that, and you leave the people in peace, so they are doing their farms, they are doing their work, they are living their lives, then it works. If you disrupt the population, you bomb them, you attack them, the population is has to run away in the forest to protect themselves, then that system doesn't work anymore because they can't get access to treatment. They stay with their parasites and they have malaria, and they transmit the disease to other mosquitoes, which in turn will transmit to other people. We could calculate that if somebody has falciparum malaria and doesn't get treatment within 48 hours, so let's say stays for 3 days with fever or 4 days with fever, right? He or she would infect about 20 other people because of the mosquitoes. So knowing the mosquitoes here, knowing how you get bitten by the mosquitoes during the daytime, you know, in the forest, outside, indoor, outdoor, then you are going to transmit malaria again. That's how we explain that in recent years, after the coup in 2021, there was so much disruption in the life of the people in the current state that there was a restarting of malaria falciparum cases, not massive, but there were some increase, and then now it's going down again. So, in other words, for falciparum, the difficulty was that it's a parasite which is it's very dangerous, but it's also very able to become resistant to drug. So that's the main property of this parasite, is that it can mutate, it can change its DNA, and it can become resistant to drugs. So it did that many times over the last hundreds of years, and it's very good at that. So we had to identify the problem, study it, and then find new treatment to replace the one that didn't work anymore, that don't work anymore. So there was a time in the 1990s where we thought that we would not have any more drugs to treat, because all the drug that we had in the pharmacy or on the market, they were becoming useless. So we thought that we were going to reach a point where we would have untreatable falciparum cases. And fortunately, that's when we got access to the Chinese drugs, the artesunate, which had been developed by the Chinese researchers during the Vietnam conflict. And so we got some of it, we combined it with some drugs that we had from the US military, and we developed this new combination therapy, and that works. And it works. So it means that we could treat the patient again. And then there were some new families of combination therapy that was developed. And now we are still living with this on this heritage of artemisinin combination therapy. So in other words, with this approach of treating the patient with appropriate treatment, which is an adequate treatment, which is an artemisinin-based combination therapy, so a combination between an artemisinin drug, which is coming from the Chinese pharmacopeia, and another partner drug, which is coming from the European or American and European pharmacopeia, then combining those, we can manage to eliminate falciparum. The problem is in Africa, because Africa is very different. The vector, the mosquito, which is transmitting malaria in Africa, is not the same than in Asia. In Asia, we have maybe 40 different type of mosquito that can transmit malaria. In Africa, you have two, and they are very aggressive, and they are very good at it, and they can survive in many different conditions. They can fly much, much further away, long distances. So there is much more transmission in, let's say, Central Africa or in the DRC or, than in Myanmar. And so that's where the problem is now. If you look at the statistics, you will see that falciparum malaria kills still about 700,000 people a year. According to WHO, which we can discuss the validity of this number, but let's say it's generally accepted that it kills several hundreds, maybe 700,000 people. Most of these deaths are in African children. And so that's where the largest problem is with this parasite. Of course, it still continues to kill people in Myanmar, but much less. I mean, it does kill people, but the transmission is much less. So the vectors are less effective. There are less cases in Myanmar than in sub-Saharan Africa country. Now, for Vivax, it's a completely different. So it's a different species. So it means that the falciparum parasite cannot mate with the Vivax parasite. So if you put the eggs and the female, because the malaria parasite has a complex cycle. There's at one stage, they are male and female's form of the parasite, which are recombining and have a sexual reproduction in the mosquitoes. You cannot mix up the species. They don't cross each other. So that's why we call them species. They are different species. So falciparum is a species, and Vivax is another species, and you have another two or three different species. But Vivax is often called the benign malaria because it doesn't kill you. It makes you sick. You have fever, you have chills, you have up and down fever, you have a headache, you may have diarrhea, you have abdominal pain, but you don't die. You don't die of Vivax malaria. So it makes you sick. You are unwell for a few days. But after a few days, even if you don't treat, you recover. Your fever will disappear. The problem is that after you have recovered, let's say 5 days of being unwell, like if you have a bad flu, for example, you know, you have a bad flu, you stay for 3 or 4 days in your bed with headache and fever, and then you recover. The same goes for Vivax, except that this parasite, this species, has a form which stays in the liver. And that form will hide in the liver for weeks or months. And then after weeks or months, it will come out of the liver and it will give you another episode of fever and being unwell. And so if you have this repeatedly and you are bitten again and you have repeatedly this butcher, then you lose a lot of time of your life in terms of works, in terms of schools. And eventually, if you are, for example, a child of 10 years old and you are living in Papua, where you are being infected by Vivax 10 times a year, then at the end, after a year or two of this, you will become anemic because every time you have an infection, the parasite is in your red blood cells, will destroy the red blood cells, will destroy them, and then you lose a red blood cell. When you lose red blood cells, you become anemic. So anemic means you don't have enough red blood cells in your blood. So that's a problem with this parasite, is that it's a burden, health burden for people, especially because it makes you sick, it makes you ill. It doesn't kill you right away, but it will cause problems, especially in children. And it does cause problem. That's another result of our research here. It does cause problem in pregnant women. And we often forget that. But vivax malaria, even if it doesn't kill people, adult or in children, it does cause abortion. It does cause miscarriage. So a pregnant woman in the first trimester of pregnancy who gets vivax, she has a higher risk of losing her babies than a woman who doesn't get vivax. So it is associated with stillbirth, abortion and miscarriage. So loss of pregnancy, loss of fetus. So the problem is, so you would then ask, why is it so difficult to eliminate vivax? The reason is that we have very few drugs to treat this parasite when it's in the liver. When it's in the blood, it's easy. You can treat it with chloroquine, with cheap drugs, with very any drugs that you want to use, you can use it and it works. But once it's in the liver, it's hiding there, and then it's very difficult to get rid of it. And the only drug that we have at our disposal are old. They are 60 years old drugs. They have been developed at the time of the Korean War, and they have been developed by the US military, because the people coming, the soldier, the GIs coming from Korea had, a lot of them had vivax. And so they discover that drug, which was primaquine, and they use it. But then they realize soon after they started to use it that, okay, it does eliminate the vivax in the liver, but in certain people, it does cause destruction of the red cells. And who are these people? They found out at the beginning that they were most African American, and then they found out that it was caused by a genetic disease, a genetic inherited disease, which is quite common in Africa, but it's also common in many other countries in South America and in Southeast Asia. And that disease is transmitted by the genes from the mother to the babies. So about 15% of the people have that disease. Normally, they don't feel it. They don't feel that they are sick. They have no problem with living. But if you give them certain drugs, then they lose the red cells. They lose their blood. And one of those drugs is the drug that we use for vivax treatment, so primaquine. So we have a problem here, because if we want to use primaquine in the population, we have to check first whether people are carrying that inherited disease, that abnormal disease in their DNA. And to do so, we can do that now quite easily, but it means that it's more complicated than falciparum. You have to test the people, and that you have to detect the people who have this inherited disease disorder, and then you cannot give them this drug, so you have to find another way to protect them against malaria. It's not easy because you have only one drug. And so, yeah, it's complicated and it's difficult. Having said all this, you can eliminate vivax, because if we go back to the beginning, I told you that in 1988, I was living in the camps. At that time, in the camps, in the refugee camps on the border, there was a lot of vivax cases. There was more falciparum cases, but there was a lot of vivax cases as well. So we had both, basically. But now in the camp, you don't have any more falciparum, but you don't have any more vivax either. So it means that both species of malaria have gone. And so if you have time, you can eliminate falciparum, good, quickly, because it kills people. So it's a nasty parasite. You eliminate it quickly. If you have time, you have 20 years in front of you, you will eliminate vivax as well. Because when you treat, the reduction of transmission makes it less and less likely that people are going to get bitten, so they have less and less parasite in their liver, and gradually that reservoir, we call it a reservoir of liver stage in the population, goes away, and then it disappears because there is no more infection. So the last liver forms comes out, they give you the last bouts of fever, the last episode, you treat them, and that's it. So if you have a lot of time in front of you, it's okay. You can get rid of vivax as well. But if you want to go faster and eliminate Vivax quicker because you want to get rid of it, because it's an impediment to the development, to the economic development of people, to their well-being, it's not nice to have fever, blah, 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 all that for good reasons. If you want to get faster, you have to find strategies to eliminate that parasite, including the form in the liver. And that's what we are working at the moment. And it's difficult because no one knows how to do this, basically, at the population. And you can find people who will tell you that they can kill parasites in the lab, in the liver cells in the laboratory. But that doesn't mean you can do it in the people. And so we are trying to find out the way to eliminate that parasite also from the population quicker. But of course, the instability, the fighting, the displacement of people, the lack of funding, all these problems don't help. It makes it more difficult to reach that goal. So I don't know whether we will succeed or not with the Vivax elimination. The other species, Ovale and Malaria, are very small. And don't ask me why they are very small, because no one knows. But they are very rare. You can find them, but they are very rare. They are very mild. They don't give people big problems, and they are easy to treat. So when we find an Ovale or Malariae, we treat them, and that's fine. There is another fifth species, which called Nolzai, and it's not really a human species. It's a malaria parasite from the monkey. From the macaque monkeys. And then it has been transmitted to humans. So in the south of Thailand and in other countries, you find patients, human beings, who have been infected by a mosquito bite carrying that parasite. And when that goes into a human, it makes that human very sick. And it's a bad episode. It may even kill you. There are not so many cases, but we see it as an increasing problem. So if you want, you can draw a parallel between this increasing problem of this parasite coming from monkey to human, and you can draw a parallel with the virus that has jumped from animal species to human in the past. And that has happened with the SARS, with maybe with COVID, etc. So the proximity of animals who have parasites, because you should know also that there are malaria parasites, different species, in many, many different animals, in monkeys, in birds, in penguins, in snakes, in crocodiles. So you have many different type of malaria parasites in many different animal species. And those parasites of animals usually, vast majority, don't infect humans. So if a mosquito bites a crocodile and get the parasite, that parasite is not going to make it to human being because it cannot survive in the human blood. Except Nolzai. Nolzai is a parasite from the macaque, and it's very common in macaque, and it can sometimes adapt to infect human. In fact, more and more often in the south of Thailand. We don't have it here. We looked for it, but we don't see it here. So for us on the border, and for most of Myanmar, as far as we know, the most problematic species of malaria are falciparum and Vivax.
Right, that's a lot there. That's a lot of really specific information that is highlighting what's happening from a medical standpoint in that geographic location and over those years. And through that description, you reference the difficulties of treating the disease, given the political instability, the fighting, the displacement that's taking place. And so I want to return to that thread and also connect that with an earlier discussion that we were bringing up of just where malaria specifically and disease in general, where that has played a role in conflict globally and historically. On the Thai-Myanmar frontier, we see the same pattern holding, that war and displacement are repeatedly driving families into jungles or overcrowded camps, creating ideal conditions, not just for malaria, but TB, diarrhea, other types of diseases. But the story runs both ways. Illness also weakens fighters and civilians alike. It saps morale. It disrupts supply chains. It limits how long people can hold out. So from what you've seen in your specific vantage point on the border, how do you see conflict and disease feeding each other, with fighting shaping these patterns of illness and then disease in turn shaping the course and limits of conflict?
Well, I think for the first part of the equation, fighting and instability and displacement have obviously a negative impact on disease, because when you introduce those elements into a population, wherever it is, then disease will flare again. So whether it's malaria, whether it's TB, cholera, and even disease which we thought were on the verge of elimination, like whooping cough or polio, are rising again, because it happens here, it happens everywhere. So in that direction, it's obvious that fighting, disruption, and instability and insecurity are fueling, all these factors are fueling the transmission of disease, especially the communicable disease. So that's what we see on the border here in the population. We see more and more cases of TB and more cases of whooping cough, and we had even a case of polio not long time ago. So that is obvious, and that has happened times and again in many different parts of the world. So we know that from many years ago, and that if you have a conflict zone, if you have a fight, if you have instability, you are breeding ground for all kinds of disease. The other way around, how disease are shaping the conflict, that's more difficult, because yes, of course, there is a classic example of, yes, during the Vietnam conflict, the U.S. military had a lot of problem with malaria, and so they developed their drug, and the Vietnamese on the other side also had a lot of problems with malaria. So probably during that conflict, you have something to do with the disease shaping the combatant force and the people. I don't know how big the role was, but it was not negligible. But here now in modern time, how does the malaria affect the conflict in Myanmar? I wouldn't know. I don't think it does have because the various parts in the conflict, the various fighting, the various armies, so to call them armies, they are aware of this, and they are taking precaution. They have medical supply for themselves and things like so. They are protecting themselves, and the transmission, at least in the current state, is not that high. So yeah, there are cases, but I don't know whether it has a real major impact on the level of conflict. Plus, the nature of conflict has changed. You see, if you compare the Vietnam conflict with the current war in Myanmar, now they are using drones, they are using, airstrikes and things which they never used before. So all this is a different type of fighting. The result, what I'm most concerned with, is the population. It's the impact on the population, and the population of farmers and villagers. If they have to move from their place and they have to run, that is not good for controlling disease. And that's how you create transmission of whether it's malaria, TB, or cholera, or other things. And the children are not getting their vaccines. So I know that there are a lot of people in different Western countries that are questioning the usefulness of vaccine. But I can tell you that here, there is no question about the usefulness of vaccines, that if you don't have them, then you see a return of, disease that were under control when we had vaccines, like measles, like polio, So we try, but it's very hard to control those diseases with with this environment. So so on the top of all this problems of insecurity, fighting and instability, we have other problems like funding has been cut, and the political problem on between different side and between different factions, different countries. So all this accumulates and makes it more and more difficult to control the impact of those infectious diseases. So what role does each of this parameter, what role does it play? What's the level of contribution of this versus that? It's a bit difficult to disentangle, but I would say that in the big picture of things, instability of the system in Myanmar is creating a security threat for the people in living in Myanmar, but also living on the border and beyond. Because when you have a country where the number of people with tuberculosis is increasing, these people with tuberculosis are going to circulate and try to find work and find treatment elsewhere. They are going to go around. They are going to go to Thailand, and they are going to go to India. They are going to go to places. And that's where they are going to contaminate other people. So I think it is indeed a security threat for the people in Myanmar itself, but also for people beyond the border. So that's it. That's for me, that's the most that's important aspect of the question. Whether the disease are shaping the or conditioning the fighting, and that it may be, but I don't know how important they are for that. I think that they are the other impact is, I mean, the other way around to look at this problem, at this question, is more relevant, more important, I think, for the near future.
Sure. And I want to return to the thread in our conversation where we picked off at the very beginning of talking, again, for our listeners' sake, referencing that there are multiple threads that are intersecting and overlapping here as we try to talk through one and then another. And one of the first threads we kicked off was the timeline of you arriving at the border in 84 and being there through this day. And so you do have this institutional history. We talked about 84, 86, 88, and then into the 90s. The next period I want to track as to what was happening on the border, both in terms of conflict, displacement, and disease, which is your specialty and why you're there, is the transition period. Because so many different voices have, especially after the coup, have commented on what this slight democratic opening really was. And certainly, I think if you were Bamar, if you were middle class, if you were in urban areas, there were really quite significant changes that were occurring in your life. And yet, in some of the ethnic regions, I mean, particularly Kachin and with the Rohingya, the transition was the so-called transition, the fake transition was a nightmare for them. In your case, on the Thai-Myanmar border and largely interacting with Karen and Kareni, I assume, populations and villages, I should mention, we have done interviews with a number of people who have been involved in the TBC and have talked about, during the transition, how they were looking at, well, maybe now Myanmar is safe and all these refugee camps that are in Thailand, they can now go back to their home country. We know that wasn't exactly the case, even though some of the cheerleaders wish that it was, and we're giving different versions. But for I'm curious about what you were seeing in this time of cautious optimism, where conflict had ebbed in some areas, there were tentative reforms that were taking shape, there were questions about camps that might look to be closing, or at least the population's going back. So how did that period of quote unquote hope look from your perspective on the border, and as well as what was possible at that time to do with treating disease? Did it open up more possibilities during that period to be able to serve the population medically more than before the 2010s?
No, they I mean, during that period of so-called transition and openness, there was a time where we could see and we could hear and we could feel that there was something happening inside Myanmar. But on the border, things were not really that spectacularly, you know, changing. There was no spectacular change. The people in the camps were, the mood was a bit better and a bit, but only few people were seriously considering going back because they wanted to see what was going to happen. And you have to also remember that at the time of this 10 years, let's say roughly 10 years, there was in the current state, there was a lot of breaking up of different factions. And so you had, on the one hand, you had a country in Myanmar where things were going to look at, going into the right direction with openness and opening, except for the Rohingyas at the end, but otherwise what's going to look like it was going into the right direction. But in fact, in current state, you had this situation where you had more and more different various groups which were antagonizing each other, like the different factions. And so you didn't have any unity here. And so that created a sort of sense that, okay, maybe there's something happening in the country, but for the current state, it's not really there yet. I mean, there's no sense that we are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And then that happened the fall. So the Rohingya crisis and then the problems that followed up. And then finally, all the way to, let's say, the COVID pandemic and something. So whether it was easier to work or not, for treatment of disease, I mean, this we started the elimination campaign aggressively going after malaria elimination in 2014. So before that, I had been to Myanmar itself several times. I had worked in different places in early 2000 in Michina, in the Kachin state, in Lashio, in Tatun, and even in Rangoon, in some hospitals. So I could feel that there might be some opportunities of development in some areas. And, you know, it was very complicated, but still maybe something was possible. But after COVID, then it broke down completely. And before that, the treatment was, we started the elimination campaign in 2014, and by 2017, so that's the time of the Rohingya crisis, by 2017 we knew that we were on the right track to eliminate malaria. So malaria had already disappeared and being eliminated in 90% of the village where we worked in Karen State. So we were encouraged by the impact of it. And it's true that we could work more, uninterrupted by fighting or by anything. So it means that the supply would go, the training would take place, the data will come back, we mapped the whole place, and we could operate. So it was good, in inverted bracket. But of course, after the closure of the border, after the COVID pandemic, And after the coup, then it became more and more complicated to operate. In summary, the sort of opening of Burma or Myanmar for some times we knew that something was happening in the country. We knew it on the border, but it was filtered on the border by the fact that, you know, the current politics were not more clear than that. And the interaction between the Burmese and the Karen was not very, very evident, very obvious what was going to happen. But on the Malaya front, we knew that we were in a good direction, the strategy was good, it's working. So it's a mixed picture that I would describe during this period of time. And after it ended with COVID, and since then it's only been more and more difficult because of the situation has deteriorated quite seriously.
And that's exactly where I want to pick off on the next question, is where we landed today. So we've tracked from pre-88 to post-88 through the transition, and now looking at following the military coup. And following the 2021 coup, there are millions of people. No one knows the exact number of how many millions are internally displaced and how many millions have crossed into Thailand in some form. And of course, Mae Sot is the height of that activity. That happened in 2021, but then after Trump's election, you had a scenario occurring on top of that where the United States froze foreign assistance / USAID grant making by roughly 90%, dismantling these lifeline programs for food, health, cross-border care. And we've only seen what the US has done as being, rather than having other countries look to fill the gaps in, there's really been somewhat of the opposite of that. You know, of course, Sweden is now phasing out its development cooperation with Myanmar. It's capping CETA support in 2025 and then terminating in 2026. And then you have multilaterals like the World Bank, the ADB, the EU, suspending development finance as well, or shifting to very limited humanitarian channels. And so then from where you sit in, Mae Sot, and looking at these donor decisions on top of the what the military itself is doing to blockade and limit access, and we're seeing, you know, just across the board clinic closures and drug stockouts, the unraveling of services and vaccines. I mean, this is where your topic of vaccines come, and in terms of not just procuring, but also being able to deliver and administer. That's another big part of this question. And of course, the Trump administration and famous, you know, and most notably RFK Jr. have expressed great hesitation and skepticism about the role of vaccines. So with all of this together that's now happening, I mean, how would you paint this current situation, both in terms of what's happening now, as well as contrasting with your institutional history of these cycles that you've seen before?
Well, I'm trying to remain optimistic. So of course, what you have described is true, and it's a huge problem. But I'm trying to see it as potentially as an opportunity. So, what has happened since the new administration decided to cut funding, and then other countries did the same, and so what has happened since then is that the community here has started to realize that the time when healthcare and education and for the population in the camp and outside the camp was going to be provided for free by international organization, this time was over. It was not going to continue because the world could not. And when I say the world, of course, the vast majority of this funding was coming from the US, but still the world was not going to continue to support it. Now, why is that? Well, there can be many reasons, and I think everybody can have their own opinion about it. But I'm trying to see it as an opportunity to reinvent and redevelop new mechanisms. So I think that in the international funding that we used to see before, there was a lot of wastage. We don't need to spend all this money for the impact that we want. Getting rid of malaria in a place like Myanmar, in a state like Karen State or on the border, doesn't need to spend that much money. And so there was a lot of sort of overkill, and not only malaria, but also other things. So I think that we can reduce, we can contract, we can go back to the essential, and we have to find new ways of financing the health system and the education system. And so that's what I'm trying to explain to the refugees, to people in the camps. But this is not the majority of the people. The people in the camp, it's only 10% of the total non-Thai population on the border. So you have 90% of the population. As you say, after the coup, a lot of people came across, and there are a lot of people that stay in the Myanmar side, and there are some people who are coming in the Thai side for various reasons. But roughly, 500,000 people live now on the Thai side of in this province, Thak province, near Mesot, north and south. So the healthcare for this population is not going to be coming from donors anymore, because of the way it is, and so we have to develop new strategy to fund it, and some of this strategy may involve that the host country, which is Thailand in this case, has to look after these people more, because actually a lot of this population is coming here to work, and their work is generating wealth for Thailand, because that's how it works, right? So in return, Thailand has to contribute to health, and it does contribute to health. It doesn't cover 100% of the needs, but it covers quite a serious proportion of the needs. Then have the specific problem of specific problem like tuberculosis or malaria, which needs some technical skills. And they are very open. The Thai are very open to advice, collaboration, and working together with us and with NGOs, with other people, to find the best way to deal with this problem. So there's no attitude from the Thai health services and the Thai Ministry of Foreign Affairs and to say, we are going to deal with it, go away. They are not saying that. And so it's good. They are very pragmatic. And so I think that is a positive sign. Now, of course, if the situation in Myanmar continues to deteriorate and there are many people more coming, and it's obvious that Thailand cannot absorb all the problems of Myanmar. That's not how it works. So there is a stage where the situation in the country in Burma will be so bad that, you know, it's a completely failed state and completely broken down health system that, you know, something will have to be done about it. But what? I have no idea. So I'm trying to remain optimistic for the small bit that can be done here, and we can try to support and try to find some additional sources of funding if we can somehow, and reduce the unnecessary spending to the minimum. But for example, to give you an example, for 40 years, the people in the camps have been fed by the TBC that you interviewed. The group of organization that provide food for refugees. This food was bought by different funding source of different countries and different churches. And now that there is no more funding, the Thai authorities, the National Security Council, has officially approved a policy allowing the people in the camp to work outside the camp. so to be part of the workforce. And so that is a move which is very important, because it means that these people, instead of being in the camp and being receiving food from donors, will be able to, I mean, some of them will be able to go out and work and get paid for their work, and then with that money buy some food. So it's a shift into what's going on the border. And I think this shift is, given the fact that Thailand is a country which, despite what we hear and what we read, despite this, in fact, it's a country that deals with this problem very pragmatically and very efficiently, unlike many developed countries, which I will not name, but you see what I mean, who are getting rid of migrants or not treating them or expelling them. Thailand doesn't do that. And so I think that given that Thailand is a country where, unlike the other country bordering Myanmar, which is China, everybody knows how China works, India, which is completely cut off from Myanmar, and with Assam state, they have a rebellion there. It's mainly militarized. Bangladesh has its own problem and cannot deal with 1 million Rohingyas refugees anymore. So Thailand is the only country where something can happen, can be done, and it's doing it. So as long as Thailand remains what it is, I think there is a hope that something can be done for the border population and the population which is relying on the border to survive. But if the situation continues to deteriorate in Myanmar, despite the election, despite whatever, then it could reach a point where it's really becoming too unstable and too degraded, and that the countries around are going to, and which country around is going to react and to intervene. It's not the US, I don't think so. It's not Europe, it's not Australia or Japan, it's going to be China, because China has geopolitical interest to. So is China going to deal with the health problem like we have been trying to do with the Thai, with the different institution for the last 50 years, 40 years? I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But waiting for that day, we will continue to try to deal with the problem as we identify them, which are for communicable disease, for infectious disease, malaria, which is not a problem anymore, but we continue to suppress it until it disappears, for falciparum and vivax. We're trying to find out how to do it, to do this, but it's not a big problem anymore. Tuberculosis is a serious problem, and providing vaccine to children, if we can, but it's very hard. But I think it's really important, because of the consequences of not immunizing children, and continue to provide for the future of their existence, to provide pregnant mothers with safe delivery, so that they can give birth in reasonable condition and reasonably healthy babies and mothers. So that's what we are going to continue to do. How long we are going to be able to do this, I have no idea, because the US cut of US aid money and foreign aid money has meant that IRC, which is the International Rescue Committee working in the camp, has gone from the camp, so it's left the camps. And we are going to be affected probably next year by the cutting funding from Global Fund, because the main contributor to Global Fund is the US, and it's the US administration. So when talking to some US officials from the embassy and from the US CDC recently, they said that we better wait for the midterm election to see what happens in the country. So we will see. It's another sort of stepping stone or deadline from that we have to watch, is what happened in the US politics. But worldwide, I don't know. I have no idea what's going to happen. What's going to happen in Myanmar for the next, in the foreseeable future, let's say 5 years, I have no idea. I'm not very optimistic. I think it's going to get worse before it's getting better, because the towering figure, the emblematic figure of Aung San Suu Kyi is fading fast. And so who is the hope is that the younger generation is going to continue to want to have its wishes and its dreams to be realized. The younger generation seems to me that they are stronger in this time that they were in 1988. They are more willing to see a change and to see that. So I hope that's a hope. That's a bit maybe a wishful thinking, but that's a hope that they are going to continue to carry the wheel of change. But we'll see. I really don't know. And maybe the discussions like the one that we just had and the one that you had with other guests and this kind of activities of trying to exchange ideas, inform each others, and talk about it using means like this, you know, this internet connection and this podcast way, which didn't exist in 1988. We didn't have that. And so now we have those tools, and maybe they are going to help. That's my hope, at least.
Yeah, certainly. And we certainly know not just the numbers of those listening, but also that we have listeners engaged at every level of the conflict, stakeholders and decision makers, different actors in this. So we certainly hope that being able to hear from informed actors such as yourself and the many others that have been so kind as to speak on our platform, that this is a new way of being able to get not just information, but the human stories and experiences that can shape decision makers and stakeholders as they're engaged in the conflict. And I think this has been a big part of that. That being said, I know you're trying to stay optimistic in these times, and I unfortunately am going to bring in another perhaps somewhat pessimistic or negative aspect and ask you to comment on. And that's that, so since the coup, in addition to everything we're talking about with conflict, displacement, disease, lack of funding, et cetera, on top of all of this, we have seen the rise of massive scam compounds that are along the border. I mean, literally from Maysat, you can stand in Thailand and literally watch these massive compound, these massive compounds, buildings being constructed on the other side of the border in Myanmar, standing in Thailand, watching it. That's how close they are. They're not like hidden in some jungle that takes a lot of work to get into. These are lawless enclaves that are run by criminal syndicates holding tens of thousands of largely trafficked workers. Overcrowded, unsanitary conditions. Survivors have reported torture, little to no medical care, outbreaks of all kinds of diseases, as one would expect, fever, coughing. And these sites are not just a crime problem, as we've talked about in other episodes, the aspect of the criminal aspect of this, but they're also potential incubators for TB, HIV, other infectious diseases that could very easily spread from the compounds and then spill across borders. This is what happens when you have a lawless area as a byproduct of the coup. And so from your vantage point, how do you see organized crime in the form of these scam centers fueling new health crises? And what dangers do you see them posing, not just for those trapped inside, but for regional health, public health more broadly?
Well, you know, it's obviously a problem because of the concentration of people and the condition in which they are working, and the very difficult access to care, to healthcare that this group of people represents. They are a problem. They are a problem, and they are a problem for health. But they are also a problem for obviously many other reasons, economic problem, and they are involved in activities which have impact on everywhere in the world. With the web, you can interact with people in the US, in people in Europe, in anywhere in the world. So So it's a global problem. And while this has been allowed to develop, because as you said, I mean, those centers are huge. They are like towns. They are real. I mean, the biggest one is probably almost as big as Mesot itself. And so it's becoming huge, and it is huge. So how it has been allowed to develop and operate in plain sight, that's, I don't know. It's puzzling me, but we have to continue to work despite this, and to come back to the problem of communicable disease, then obviously, I think the health authorities, not in Myanmar, because they are not concerned about this, but in Thailand and elsewhere, they are concerned. They are concerned about the potential risk of spread of disease. It's tuberculosis, cholera, HIV, and other problems. But I found that the people are quite embarrassed. I mean, not embarrassed is not the right word, but they find it difficult to know what to do, because there is, you know, it's not like you are dealing with a group of an ethnic group or minorities or an alternative government or something. You are dealing with people who have completely different system of thinking. So they are not concerned about public health. They are not concerned about the health of their own people. So they are not interested by the same thing they are not interested by public health at all. So it's quite hard actually to know what to do. And so in the recent years, since the Chinese government has been, you know, you could read this in the newspaper, the Chinese government has demanded to the Thai government to take action to try to stop those illegal centers. Then it's much more complicated for us to work and deliver healthcare to villages in that area because everything is being blocked and so it does impact healthcare delivery for villages and communities in those areas, and those scamming centers, those big illegal centers, are spreading fast. So they are. It's not only one big center. There are several centers along the border. It's growing, and it continues to grow. And they are not only around here. There are also some in the north of the border between Myanmar and China, and Thailand and Myanmar, I think. So it's a real issue, and it's not very obvious to me what's going to happen to this. I can't really think that this kind of infrastructure, because we are talking about big buildings with roads and streets and sanitation and commerce, it's like town. You are talking about a town, so I can't understand how a town like this has been allowed to grow, and without any plan, you know, planning in the future of what to do with this town. I don't think it's going to stay the center for illegal activity forever. It's going to be transformed into something else, because there is no example in the world where you have a city which is 100% dedicated to illegal activity would remain there forever. I mean, when the situation in Myanmar, one day, hopefully, Myanmar situation will improve, there will be a government, there will be, I don't know, a federal state, there will be some law and order and authorities in there. These groups will disappear, they will go somewhere else. But what will remain of the infrastructure? It would be used for something. It's not going to be demolished, because you don't demolish a big town. It's like So it's very difficult to apprehend for me. But I do agree with you that this is a very destabilizing phenomenon, and it has transformed the border in a way which is difficult to apprehend. In the past, if you go back to 88 or 89 or 90, the main issue around here was wood, tick exploitation for wood, precious stones, very little drug trafficking, very little, because it was not happening here. So now this has completely changed. Now with this human trafficking, it's a lot of drug trafficking and a lot of and all these illegal systems, scanning system activities. So it has really transformed everything. And I don't know what will be the impact of this in the long term. But for the disease, it's certainly a threat. Yes, it's certainly an issue, because of the population living in those centers, in those places, coming from all over the place. You have people coming from Africa. You could see in the media when the people were so-called liberated and sent back. You had some Chinese, obviously, that went back to China, but you had also some Ethiopian, Somalian, Pakistanis. You have all sort of nationalities which are found themselves in these places, and that's for the transmission of disease and the bringing of cases of communicable disease is a recipe for epidemic and disaster. So, it certainly is a concern. And the problem is that the means, financial means and technical means, and in medicine and to deal with these problems, is going to be harder and harder to find. So you are right to say that this is not an optimistic element in the discussion. But still, despite those problems, I still hope that we can find a way.
Well, in looking at that possibility to find a way, I'm thinking of this being partly a health issue and partly a political issue, and there are ways to theoretically separate those. And I'm thinking of like examples of like going into corners and streets that where there's a lot of drugs and providing free needles, or you know, working with going to treat sex workers and being able to provide some kind of medicine or protection to sex workers. And so, you know, thought of in that way. And then historically also, when you look at Myanmar itself, there have been moments when health workers have had to negotiate access with armed groups or even criminal actors just to be able to reach vulnerable populations. And so, you know, this is partly a health question and partly a political question. This might be the political part of it might be a little above your pay grade in knowing what's possible, but would, you know, if not, would still be really curious to hear your thoughts on possibilities. If you think there's any realistic way to engage with or even work through some of these, you know, and can't believe I'm saying this, organized crime networks to be able to separate that political and, you know, that crime and illicit element for the purposes of containing the spread of disease in these enclaves. Of course, that's a risk that can legitimize them in ways that might backfire and would have a lot of pushback in other directions. But going off of what you said a bit ago, that these are cities, these are buildings, like these are roads, like these are here to stay. And so, like it or not, you know, they could be transformed, but how do you transform a multi-billion, you know, multi-billion dollar industry? That's not easy. So if we're looking at some kind of permanence of their existence, what are your thoughts of trying to engage in a way that just focuses on the health itself?
No, we try to engage in some questions with related to health, but it's very difficult because, as I said, the terms of the engagement are very different. I mean, we can engage with armed groups and then, you know, different parties. And during COVID, for example, we went to immunize different groups, and that's okay. We have no problem. But these particular groups have a completely different sort of, you know, state of mind. So if we said, well, we would like to screen the whole population for TB and treat the positive, that doesn't work because they won't give you access to that. So we are not trying very hard because we have limited resources to do it and we have other things. But I know in Myanmar, for example, and in other countries as well, that there are groups that are working with sex workers, with drug addicts. Even in Thailand, you know, there are people, we are collaborating with people who are treating hepatitis C in IV drug addicts, because hepatitis C will kill them, so that we treat them and then try to help with the, you know, clean syringes and all that stuff. So we are familiar with that kind of approach, but except that here, I found it very difficult to, you know, to engage with people who are not interested to talk about health and don't really care for health of their workforce. They don't seem to care. So now on the question of what can be done with this infrastructure, you just look at what happened in Laos. They did the same in the same happened in Laos 10 years ago. There was a big town at the border between China and Laos, which was a gambling casino and illegal sex workers and things. And they developed it. They built it and they build this infrastructure, this big building, you see. And then now it's been transformed as a legitimate crossing point with a fast train, you know, high speed train, railway station, and export import of a totally legal business. So you can transform a place like this into a legitimate business place. It's a question of political wills and time. So I think it will happen in one, maybe in 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years. I don't know, but it will not stay there as a problem forever. However, in the meantime, of course, there are some concern, and we have to try to cope with the consequences. But intervening directly, face to face with the problems here in this kind of environment is, and plus it's dangerous because you don't know what will be, you know, what can happen, and you send your health workers to a place where, you know, you don't know what the reaction can be or what the consequences could be. So because there is nothing like in, you know, you cannot get a contract, you cannot sign any paper, you cannot get anything on the table. Everything is sort of illegal, and so there is nothing firm that you can base your intervention. With other groups, you can always discuss and then decide something together, and then more or less the trust is there, but here there's very little trust on both sides, so it's hard. But nevertheless, we still manage to provide some services to the population, the local population, which has been moved, but is in the neighborhood and in the region, and so we are busy with that. And the rest, if we are being asked to help, we go and help, or we do help. For example, in the beginning of this year, there was an outbreak of cholera, which affected some of the centers. So we help to deal with it, but it's very punctual. It's not long term. We don't try to build anything or do anything long term because it's too uncertain, too risky. Even some of the program in other parts, not talking about those centers, those illegal centers, but some other parts where we've tried to implement some long-term health program that needs stability, but in fact, it's so unstable that we have to pull out. So it's always, you are always looking at a balance, an equilibrium, a balance between what you can do and what the situation allows you to do, and you have to measure that equilibrium, and then maybe sometimes you have to have the courage or the you have to pull out. I mean, because you can't operate. For example, immunizing children, you don't immunize children in the middle of a fighting place where people are shooting at each other. You don't do that. And so you have to balance the risk and the benefit.
So the last question I have here, and I so appreciate you taking the time to have such an in-depth conversation about such wide-ranging topics that you have expertise on. And this last question is a topic that could be in and of itself a whole other episode. You've referenced this throughout. And so in some ways, we can barely do it justice by fitting at the end. But I think we have to talk about tuberculosis directly and clearly, because this is another outside of malaria. This is TB is a extremely serious disease that has cropped up on the border. It's haunted refugee and IDP camps, often as deadly as malaria, as I understand, in those early years. And then after the 2021 coup, the entire TB and also HIV programs, it essentially collapsed, leaving hundreds of thousands without treatment. And these are including patients with drug-resistant strains. As I understand it, TB is a disease that demands strict, months-long adherence to therapy. This is nearly impossible when people are being displaced, hiding in jungles, constantly moving, to say nothing of, again, of all these funding cuts. And Myanmar's already faced some of the highest MDR TB rates across Asia, and now we have these supply chains and clinics that are breaking down further. So yes, sorry, adding more to this pessimistic outlook as we're all trying to be optimistic. But this is in context of not just one crisis, but as a recent guest discussed, and as a scholar had written on this, and I think has been overly clear on this conversation, this is not one crisis. This is a polycrisis where conflict, displacement, disease, aid withdrawal, all of these things are colliding in Myanmar's case. And so from your perspective, what does this perfect storm mean for TB today? And what are the consequences that are risked if the treatment gaps and the drug resistance, if it continues to grow unchecked?
Well, I mean, it's true that tuberculosis is more of a problem for us now than malaria is. And so we are facing more cases of TB than almost cases of malaria now in our clinics on the Thai side of the border. So the reason, as you have said, the reason is that there is a breakdown of services on the Myanmar side. So people with tuberculosis have to try to find treatment somewhere, and they are trying to find treatment wherever they can. So they come to Thailand. They are being treated either by the Thai system or by us, but the resources are, you know, limited. So we try to treat as many people as we can and detect as many people as we can. Now the problem of drug resistance is not getting worse. In fact, we have about 8% of the cases which are drug resistant. So it's been stable for the last 10 years. It's not getting worse, at least not yet, as far as we can see. Now, I don't know about other part of Myanmar. They could be, but in the small part that we see, which is on the border here, the problem of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis has not got worse. But having said that, tuberculosis is still a very serious problem worldwide because it causes the death of more people than any other infectious disease, more than malaria, more than cholera, more than Ebola, more than any other disease, more than HIV. And the problem with tuberculosis is that it's airborne. So it means that somebody with tuberculosis is traveling by plane or by car or by on the sky train in Bangkok or elsewhere by train somewhere, and you are sitting next to that person, you could very well be contaminated. And everybody can get tuberculosis. Whether you have been immunized or not, you can get it. And so because the BCG vaccine doesn't protect you against being infected with tuberculosis, it protects you against the the meningitis, so the brain part of the brain the involvement of your brain into the disease, which is a severe concern. But TB itself, most of the time, will affect the lungs, and it will be gradually. It's a long term disease. It can take years, and finally, it will kill you after all your lungs have been destroyed. So it's a disease that impacts a lot of the society everywhere in the world, but especially in Asia. And it's difficult to treat because it's even in the simple form of TB, which is not multi-drug resistant, it takes 6 months of treatment. Now we have some treatment 4 months, but it takes months of treatment, and that's a logistic problem because I don't know if you had to treat yourself for a sore throat or some sort of infection, but taking 1 week of antibiotic is already difficult, but taking months of antibiotic is really hard. So it's a problem of which is, you know, it's so easy in malaria, you get 3 days of treatment and you are cured, but tuberculosis takes months, and so it's a much harder problem to deal with. And the breakdown in services and the breakdown in health system in Myanmar, of course, it's a contributing factor. Tuberculosis is a disease of poverty, so it thrives in community where not access, they don't have access to health, they don't have access to healthcare, they don't have access to, they are poor, they are struggling. That's a perfect storm for tuberculosis. So I think that if I put myself into the position of the Thai health minister or foreign affairs, or then I will look at the problem of Myanmar mostly in focusing on this kind of problem, tuberculosis and this kind of infection, rather than even malaria, because malaria, the Thai knows very well how to deal with it. But tuberculosis, once you have people being infected with tuberculosis on your border and in your country, that's a real hard one to deal with. So we are being supported by the Global Fund to treat as many cases as we can. We offer them treatment. We have sanatorium system where we keep them, we give them food, we give them shelter, we treat them for 6 months. And it's a heavy program. It works. People are getting cured, they go back to their work, they go back to their family, they are cured, but it's heavy and it's not cheap. So if funding is being cut, what will happen to all these TB patients? I have no idea. I think that tuberculosis will explode again. And there are some specific problem in the center that you mentioned before, those scamming center, those illegal casino center where people are inside rooms where they are working all day long doing their work, but they contaminate each other. So we have a lot of cases of TB among this population as well. And so that's a threat. That's a very clear threat to the local population and to the population in the region. So, I think that the long term, the well, even not very long, the medium term consequences of Myanmar falling apart. If you look at diseases, it's quite clear that tuberculosis and some other disease, especially the childhood disease, but also cholera and some typhoid and other disease, are a big threat to the stability of the region. But unfortunately, this kind of threat, you have it in many different parts of the world. And so maybe the foci of attention on Myanmar is not there. Then people don't, you know, Myanmar is not on the radar screen of any of the big players here. And so whether we are right to remain optimistic, I don't know, but we have to. Well, I think we try not to give up, because if we give up that fight, then then it means that everything we've been doing for many years will be lost, and that's a very difficult reality to contemplate.
And I think on that somber note, that's a fitting place to end. A somber note that also brings in that hope of optimism, which I agree with. I mean, if you, for those of us who've been doing anything at all, anywhere up until now, if you believe, if the work that you happen to be engaged in doing, if you believe in the value of that work and the people who benefit as a result, through difficult times that present themselves, you just keep trying, because otherwise, why did you start anything in the first place?
Exactly. Yes. And also all the people which have that survived and have been cured, and all the children and all the pregnant women who are still alive, and all the TB patients. Only for those people, it's already a good thing. So I'm constantly reminded that at least for all these people who are there and living their life, it was worth it. But the future, what it will bring, how it will evolve. But I think you can say that with many situations in the world, how is the US going to evolve? How Russia is going to evolve? So that's another topic for discussion. Well, I think we have to keep trying what we believe in, and then we must not despair. And whatever we are involved with, I think we have to keep being kind to others, and the world will remember it.
Before we sign off, I want to take this opportunity to sincerely thank those of you who have chosen to contribute to our wider Better Burma nonprofit mission. In addition to supporting our humanitarian work, we simply could not continue to provide you with the content and information through our podcast channel without the wonderful support of generous donors, listeners, and friends like you. Each episode provides access to one more voice, one more perspective, one more insight. Every donation of any size is so greatly appreciated and helps us to continue the mission. So we take this time to say thank you. To find out how you can contribute, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation.
Yarananda, Dayananda, Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,